Hello and welcome to The Great Game, an Australian Mega Games podcast. I'm Jack and I will shortly be joined by Pat to interview Tom, Chris and Zane from Very Large Huge Games about their Mega Game First Contact, the 200 player Mega Game about Alien Arrival. It was first run in June last year and they're gearing up to run it again on the 20th of May this year in central London. Which should be an absolutely amazing experience. So I definitely recommend that if you're in the area, check out www.verylargehugegames.com. Tickets are still on sale now, so I think if you get in, you'll be able to get there, which should be awesome. In terms of news closer to home, God Emperor will be running in May, so check out the Sydney Mega Gamers if you're interested in joining in for that one. Sydney Mega Gamers on Facebook would be a good place to find them. And Melbourne Mega Games will be running Lore, a Greek mythology role-playing game. So not a mega game, but a role-playing one-shot tabletop RPG experience inspired by ancient myth, run in association with the Hellenic Museum in Melbourne, which sounds absolutely amazing. So if you're interested and you are in that area, check it out. It's starting up on the 4th of March, and you can check Melbourne Mega Games out on their Facebook page, Melbourne Mega Games, or Twitter at Melb Mega Games. And without further ado, on to the interview. Zane, Tom and Chris, let's start with you, Zane. Give us a brief introduction of yourself and how you got into the mega game scene.
I'll keep it very, very brief because as someone just said a minute ago, there's a whole bit about me on the Mega Game Assembly podcast. So yeah, I got into mega gaming about 7 years ago, designing and running games in the south of England.
Fantastic. And how about you, Tom?
Last time we did an introduction on a podcast, we all made a very funny joke about how we got into mega gaming in different ways through playing this weird game called Watch the Sky. So I'll try and spare you that. But I got into mega gaming because I watched a video of a game that looked fun called Watch the Skies. And then I just started turning up to things and enjoying them. And then at a certain point was like, because I was never a designer or anything. And at a certain point, I was just like with some of my friends, Chris and Zane and Matt and so on. And we were just like, we should run Watch the Skies again. And then I suddenly became a game designer. And that's that.
Classic. Awesome. And how about you, Chris?
Yeah, like probably everybody, I saw the famous video, got into it after that, and it hasn't got rid of me yet. So yeah, and somehow I've fallen into First Contact. So yeah, all good.
And that's a pretty significant run for you all, 2016 onwards. Zane, obviously, we will link to that interview that you did with Mega Game Assembly, talking about yourself for an hour and a half. But for the other two, Tom and Chris, was this First Contact, was this your first time actually doing the design work, or did it come earlier?
Yes, yeah, and it was so... The genesis of the game was actually Chris and me, and we were in the pub. We'd been in the pub several times after several other games, and we were talking about how we got into it, and we were like, that Watch the Skies game was... Because Chris played in the fourth run of it, which was the third big one, and I played in the second or third run... I played in two of the big ones, and Chris played in the other big one, and we didn't cross over, and then we started crossing over other games. And we were talking in the pub, that was really good, we should do that again, we should do that again. And then we were like, why isn't anyone else doing that again? And we were like, after about the fifth or sixth conversation, we were like, oh, we're going to have to do this again. And that's that really, I mean, from my perspective, that really was it. Like, I play a lot of games, I play... quite a few mega games, quite a few sort of board games, video games, all that sort of thing. But I, you know, except as a kid trying to basically copy word for word Games Workshop rules, I've never really done any games design.
Yeah, it's funny. Actually, I had a similar epiphany when I started getting into board games and then this design stuff. I remembered back, I was like, wait a minute, I was kind of doing this when I was like a young teen, but really I was just copying stuff blatantly and not making anything new up. But I'd been doing it all along and not realizing.
I my parents dug out some rules I'd written to play with, like these kind of medieval knights and Saracens that were probably not on sale anymore because they're presumably quite racist. But I had this whole system where, like, basically you were rolling like six-sided dice and so on, but I had forgotten to put like to hit, to wound, and to save rolls in. So if you attack someone and you rolled a 4+, they died, and so none of the games worked very well because it was just you'd advance and hit someone with a sword and they'd be dead, and it just wasn't satisfying. And I've taken that design philosophy into my mega games.
Right.
Yep. Excellent. So you decided to jump into the deep end then, with, you know, your first mega game being a 200 person one.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
I think we were heading for 300 to begin with. We were talked down from that.
Yeah. Well, so the original plan was just to talk to Jim, who is just a guy who we all know, who turns up to games and so on, and just be like, look, can we run Watch the Skies again? But we want to tweak it a little bit because we didn't say we felt the science didn't work, but we were like, we want to tweak it a little bit because there's some little things about it that maybe we could sort of change very little, but we just want to run it again. Yeah. And we started, and then we got it, and we were like, this bit's missing. Well, maybe we'll just write this bit, and we'll write this bit. And then suddenly we were like, oh, God, we're going to have to design this whole thing. And at that point, we started, we were talking to Matt, and Matt was like, oh, I've got this concept for the aliens. So we brought him in to design, and then we spoke to Zane and were like, we just need someone to do the science a little bit. And Zane was like, yeah, I'll just come on and do the science. And then 2 minutes later, he was absolutely integral to the whole thing. And we were doing like a total rewrite. And then that total rewrite became a completely different game.
I'm sorry. It would have been a far simpler exercise if you'd have just run Watch the Skies. But you can't keep me away from these things.
it does sound like a kind of a scope creep kind of thing, where you sat down, you clearly had an idea, you wanted to make that big game happen again and again, and then when you realized you had to take the reins, yeah, the doors opened. I was going to ask whether or not the idea came where you were sitting in the pub thinking, let's do this giant Watch the Skies again, or let's just do a big mega game. But it sounds like Watch the Skies and that alien arrival kind of geopolitical theme was pretty integral.
We just wanted to recapture that feeling of our first time, and it happened to be that Watch the Skies bottled lightning and was one, like, just a wonderful experience, like formative experience for us and loads of people we knew. But like, I don't think any of us really had any proper idea about like how it was, what the kind of superstructure of it was, or how it was underpinned, or indeed how like game design, even in the small space of mega games, had kind of come on in so many ways since the game was written in 2014 and 2015. The plan wasn't to like, let's reinvent the wheel or let's find an incredible thing. The plan was to play Watch the Skies again.
Yeah. Mm. Yep.
200 with 300 people. And then we saw that there were lots of roles in the really big Watch the Skies that had slightly uneven experiences, and we were like, oh, we'll just cut out the Pope, because the Pope always ends up in space. The Pope's always in on the moon, and that's his entire day. It's just a guy in a robe on the moon or on a balcony in a theatre saying, hello, everyone, I'm the Pope and I'm on the moon now. And then there's like loads of NGOs which sometimes have tricky days, and then you kind of drill down and suddenly you're like ripping entire bits of like cabling that you don't understand what it does out.
Yes. Yeah, and I think that's what a lot of people's experience was. It's interesting that your team followed that same experience, whereas others like Jack and I, we both did the same thing, but it was more about us looking at Watch the Skies rules and not really getting it because we had never run it. We'd never been part of a mega game ourselves, let alone Watch the Skies. And for someone who isn't already in the scene, you look at the rules and you know, a lot of it just doesn't really click into place. So you naturally just start to pull bits apart and try to make it make sense in your head.
Absolutely. I think I had exactly the same experience, because I ran a game before I ever played one and then designed a game. And it's it. You have to sort of pull it apart to try and understand it. It's the only way to comprehend it, is you have to sort of pull it apart and try rewriting it. I think it's probably at that point that we sort of stepped back a little bit and said, what is it we're actually trying to achieve?
Yeah.
And it was actually setting up some sort of high level objectives for us of what the kind of experience was we wanted to create.
Right.
You know, we wanted to sit back and go, actually, that big experience, that first time, that large mega game of hundreds of people, that buzz. But actually, you know, what is it that's got that lovely feeling about Watch the Skies? Is it a blockbuster? We want to recreate that sort of blockbuster movie feel, and also try and bring more people into the hobby. And those were sort of two of our sort of guiding objectives, which really helped sort of write those rules and sort of shape the game we ended up with.
Awesome. So what are the big points that this game diverges from Watch the Skies in? What are the big changes that you ended up making?
In summary.
In summary, yeah, I mean.
I think it's not sort of how different we are from Watch the Skies. I think Watch the Skies is the inspiration, absolutely. Yeah. But it was quite clear what we were trying to do was different from what Watch the Skies was trying to simulate. And it was at that point with those sort of high-level objectives of, actually, we want a blockbuster movie. This is Independence Day, you know, all those, it's Arrival, it's all those movies. We want every player to feel that they're a part in one of those films.
Mm-hmm. So with the changes that you did make to change that experience to meet those objectives and give the players what you thought they should get out of it, were most of your changes thematic, the story-wise, like about the story of the game? Were they about the mechanics?
Probably a little bit of both.
Yeah,
I think the mechanics sort of underpin the theme.
Originally, I got certainly before Zame came on, and like I was like, well, Jim's design philosophy is as lean as possible, which is because he's got loads of experience designing these big games, and he knows full well that the more complexity you layer on it, the easier it is for everything to fall over. And I didn't know that. So I was just like, yeah, no, well, the combat in Watch the Skies felt very flimsy. So we'll beef up the combat system. We'll beef up the science research, and we'll beef up the corporations, and we'll beef up the UFOs. And I'd say it's probably about 75% of the things that we beefed up, we then ripped out ourselves after we realized it wasn't working. Yeah, in the end, it turns out simplicity is really good in a game of this size, because otherwise it does fall over. It's just we built it up and then simplified it down into a different shape. If that makes sense. So we haven't taken the same conclusions about simplicity as Jim. So it's a thematically fairly parallel game, but mechanically there's not that much similar. The interceptions are pretty similar, to be honest.
No, I think we also, one of my big things, I mean, I'm not a designer. I'm not going to even try to claim to be. The guys are much more on the mechanics than I am. I'm more admin bitch. But, like, I definitely felt that we should have stronger briefings. And certainly, I mean, the biggest team is the US in the game. And if it's full, it's 11 players. So it's a huge team. And their briefing document is like, I don't know, I think it's now hit 5 pages. So they've got lots of objectives they want to hit. Obviously, not all of them they can hit. You know, there's only 11 of them. They've got to try and manage a lot of things on the day. But it was to give every team, even if they're a small team in Africa, every team something that to do, to, you know, they could hook themselves into and get a great day out of. Because sometimes you go to a game and, you know, you don't know what you're doing and it's very difficult. But yeah, absolutely wanted to make sure people had things to hook themselves into.
Yeah. And that design conclusion of, okay, everything needs to be a bit simpler, I think that's a pretty common one. Most people we talk to, and definitely myself, have come to in designing games. Did you find it a challenge to differentiate between making it simpler but also keeping it clear? Because I feel like often once mechanical design becomes simple, it also starts to become vague and sort of fluffy and interpretive. Did you run into that, or was that just par the course?
Zane will probably want to say something about this as well, but actually, no, I don't think we found that. I'd say mega game design traditionally in this country has always been like a one-man band thing, and it's sort of auteur type thing. And that is great for strength of vision and sort of moments of inspiration and so on. But actually, it can leave big old holes in your design. And there are, I think everybody's played mega games where they've wanted it to work more than it actually has worked, which is something that seems to be less of a problem in like other places, because there's less of that particular design culture. And so we were really aided by basically having four of us to kind of bounce the design ideas off, or you know, to talk it through. So actually, we found that we could cover way more ground, and we therefore have what I think are pretty satisfying mechanical interactions between pretty much every role in the game. You know, there are some roles that aren't really meant to talk to each other, and therefore they won't have much to do with each other, but everybody has like a web of meaningful interactions they can have with everybody else. And Zane put a lot of work into making like the science game and the corporation games talk to all the other parts of the game, which are maybe like their secondary goals. So I would say in that simplicity, we have tried really hard not to just hand wave it and say, well, control will sort this out. We were just actually, Zane and I, before this call, were going through the corporation handbook, and there was one thing where we deliberately in the first run left it nebulous about how you reincorporate in another country, which is a tiny little rule, and it mostly affects certain corporations' objectives. And we actually mechanized that because we realized it's something that if you leave it up to control will be differently applied and therefore unfair. And so we've taken that, I think, principle through. Am I right?
And unfair for the control to have to come up with it in the moment. I think that's another part of that, is actually the more you can keep it simple but codify it, the more you're supporting your control team. I was going to say, in the heat of the moment, we all know what it's like when you're running a game and you've got, you know, loads of questions being thrown at you and you're trying to kind of fill those holes. It can be quite difficult, and it can be a sort of almost a make and a break of some games, because if you make the wrong call, it can impact the game quite badly. Whereas if you've actually codified that into some simple rules, it really helps. And so we have to say we were really supported, not just by us four, but the wider community as well, who helped sort of play test and things like that. And they, in fact, helped come up with some mechanics for helping the control team adjudicate stuff. A little sort of simplified cost system for if players want to do this and it's got this kind of effect, make them pay this kind of thing. And little bits like that really helped.
Yeah, that I think that budget was really helpful for people to sort of contextualize what we felt each, like, different kind of currencies were worth to different parts of the game. And that kind of, yeah, gives you a yardstick about, you know, am I about to massively overcharge someone for something just because I'm unfamiliar with, you know, the system of grace and favor that the science works on, rather than the system of mega credits that the national budgeting works on.
That makes total sense. That sounds really useful. This is skipping ahead a bit, but yeah, how many control people did you have in the game in total on the day?
I think it was something like 35.
A few people weren't able to make it in the end, so we were a couple of people down, and actually we did notice the kind of because we have like liaison roles at the maps whose job it is basically to run around all the other parts of the game and report you know, stuff on the map that's affecting people's GDP, so like report that feedback to the GDP map, so people are actually like losing income for unresolved crises on their map. And the maps that had the liaison functioned better with those kind of mechanical rules than the ones that didn't. Some people either made too much money because they weren't being charged, or lost too much money because they were being overzealously charged.
Right. So how did you handle the communication between such a large control team? Did you find any issues of things not being communicated or across the game or things like that? Because I can see it being a huge problem in such a large mega game.
We set up quite a solid structure for our facilitators. So we slightly rebranded our controllers for facilitators. And we set up a bit of a structure around it. So we had three different type of facilitators. We had a sort of plot or narrative facilitator, a mechanical facilitator, and a liaison facilitator. So the plot ones, the narrative ones, they dealt with the sort of story points and stuff like that going on. The mechanical ones looked after the maps, or if it was alien, or the rules for corporations or science. And then these liaison ones, it was their job to make sure that the narrative and the rule bits were fitting together. So if a plot had happened, it was actually having an impact, say, on the map or on the player's table, so on their like GDP mats or whatever it happened to be. And then above that, we sort of had two sort of other plot controls that were looking after, one looking after the sort of human bits and then one looking after corpse and science. So they were looking after the wider narrative, and they would then have a little catch up with all the various other plot controls and feed stories across. And I think it worked okay. I think it could be made tighter, but it worked pretty well. I think we didn't lose too much information considering the size of the game.
We've actually got 40 people, I think, signed up to help us next time. So yeah, we'll have a few more people to help sort of balance that out and make it even stronger.
Yeah. Did you try to utilize any technology to help with that?
Chris, I'll let you talk about Slido if you like.
I did. Hate technology.
I did ask you if there was anything you didn't want me to mention. But,
My God, my blood pressure's just raised. so I work in IT as my day job, and I just don't think, and I'm very, Zane doesn't agree with me on this, but I don't think technology should be in mega games. I think mega games are social exercises and technology just detracts from that. But saying all that, we put a couple of technology pieces into the game. I don't know who made those decisions, probably me, I don't know. We decided to put them in, and we had Slido to do voting at the UN. And unfortunately, that fell apart pretty quickly because we didn't realize, I should have tested more. It's definitely on me, but we didn't realize before the game that basically you can run one Slido poll at a time, not more than one. Yeah. So when in the first turn, predictably, the UN came along and said, oh, we want to run two polls, but we can't do it. How do you do it? So I had jumped on there and had a look, and you can't do it. So very quickly, by the end of turn one, Slido was abandoned, and it was sort of, I think at the foot of the stairs, the foreign ministers who had to vote in the UN each turn stood there and listened to what the UN Secretary General was saying about what that was going to be proposed to be voted on resolution-wise. And that happened every game, every sort of turn throughout the day after that, after a bit of a kerfuffle at the beginning. So yes, basically we stripped it out completely. So now it's going to be a sticker situation. So very, very low tech.
Yeah,
but no, I just don't think, especially the size of First Contact, just doesn't work in my opinion. But I know others have different opinions.
I'd come back at Chris with that of actually the other piece of technology we had was amazing, and we're using it again in the next one. So the turn timer app that was designed.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
I mean, that's almost foolproof, right? Did you have a custom made sort of dashboard that you could update? And
we did, and it's got space for news tickers for the stuff that couldn't go into the press broadcast, and all sorts of things. There are a couple of issues. One, the venue's Wi-Fi wasn't quite good enough that sometimes the turn timer stalled. So while I was kind of comparing the game, I occasionally had to. We're fixing that because somebody's bought a big Wi-Fi booster. So I think we'll be fine in the venue the second time. The technology was fine. It was the internet.
Yeah. The fact you could check it on your phone. So yeah, I don't know, Chris, whether you want to give a shout out to Patrick for that, because
Paddy Rose. Developer of what has he done? Now you put me on the spot. Crikey.
Running Hot. He's done
Running Hot. He's done Running Hot. He's
Dave Anatomy as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. He's a developer in his real life. So he developed that for us, and he's making some revisions for the second run. We've also got another friend called Patrick as well. So it's the Team Patrick. He is doing a sort of front end, so we can hopefully jazz it up a bit for the second run. But nice. I have to say, yeah, the turn timer did work very well. I mean, it was on the venue's Wi-Fi, as Tom mentioned. It wasn't on the turn timer that it didn't work. And I think we switched to Zane's phone in the end. But yeah, turn timer's great. Nothing else.
Though. We are boosting the size of the news ticker because some people reported on the screen they couldn't quite see it. But that's like, that's not a tech problem. That's like a beta testing problem, I guess.
Mm. Yeah, right.
But I strongly recommend that for if you, because certainly in a game of this size, the amount of news that it kicks up is huge. Mm. And you can budget 5 to 7 minutes for a press broadcast, but that's not enough, really. So like minor, important headlines are really good. Having them on a news ticker where people can see them at their own leisure without basically having to like waste 45 minutes explaining the situation on a 45 mm-hmm. seconds explaining the situation on the press broadcast.
With these sort of heated backroom conversations about technology, did you consider or are you considering using any kind of tech for the facilitator side to sort of manage data between different facilitators and different maps, that kind of thing?
We don't actually need to. I think we've designed it in a way that it basically runs independently. So each map essentially is running independently. So you're only sharing information that's necessary and it doesn't matter if it doesn't quite get shared.
Right.
So we don't need that level of sort of technology to support that. I mean, I will say at this point that we're going to introduce an AI to help run it and reduce the number of facilitators. So, you know.
I've heard ChatGPT is quite cheap, honestly. Yeah. 10 billion or something? I'm sure we got that in the back, in the back pocket. Yeah. Fine.
Awesome. Well, let's dive a bit deeper into the core mechanics and the design of the game. I think like the core sections of it, starting with the science game. I think you mentioned that that was an area you wanted to revitalize a bit or change up. How does it work in the, what's the elevator pitch for it in the modern version of First Contact?
So I think I'll jump in on that and say, going back to that blockbuster movie, in my mind, what I want the science game to be is that scientist that runs in screaming that they know what's going on and they can solve it. So to do that, it's actually a very free-form game. So it's a very free-form part of the game. They can basically try and come up with any idea to research. Because some of these ideas are quite long-ranging and quite large, there's a sort of pinata of bonuses and extra little stuff they get out of it as they're researching it. So it might take 2 or 3 turns to actually research the death lasers or whatever it is, or colonizing the moon. They'll also get some mechanical benefits out of it as we're going along to encourage them to do this. The scientists also have some sort of ideological beliefs about what they think the aliens are and how the aliens might react with the humans. I can't say that much more without spoilers, but it is giving them a little bit more than, they're not attached to nations anymore. They're more groups of scientific institutions.
Oh, really? That's interesting. So each team, it's not like the German team has a German scientist. It's more.
We've adjusted it a little bit from the first run. The first run, there were 10 independent scientists, each of a different institution. We've sort of, working alone, people didn't have that much fun, so we've grouped them into teams of 3, so 5 teams of 3 instead, so that they're actually working in a bit more of a collaborative team.
And how does so if they're independent, how do they decide which countries they want to share their research with, or does it automatically, like, how do they relate to the countries?
So they need research teams off the countries and funding. So and the briefings that we've pulled together and these objective cards that we've introduced, and I'm sure we'll talk about our objective cards and stuff, mean that the human nations want something. So they have plans. They want to be the first nation to put their flag on Mars, and in which case they need to talk to the science teams to make that a reality, or they want to build the largest dam in somewhere or other or whatever it happens to be, and they need the science teams to do that. But the science teams, they aren't creating technology like the corporations. So the corporations are making the stuff to build the jets and weapons and giant hospitals or whatever it happens to be. The science stuff is more odd prototypes. It's more, can they counter bits of climate change? Can they change the perception of physics? Can they come up with a new mathematical formula for explaining something or other? They probably won't ever do that. They'll probably try and make death lasers because we don't know what players are like. But, you know, you can have grand expectations.
Of course, of course.
The science game worked, I thought, pretty well, honestly. There were several occasions where people would come up to me mid to late game and say, can I do such and such? Can I go and visit the aliens? I've got this atmospheric breathing gills card. Or I've got the atmosphere, I've got the gills card. I was like, the what? Because they assumed we'd written this into the game, but it hadn't. Like the science game just invented outputs that were put onto, we had blank cards and they could write onto the blank cards, and the science facilitators would curate what rules they could and couldn't break. And there were loads of these things that just ended up in the game that allowed them kind of just the players emergently to do things that we hadn't planned for, which I thought was brilliant.
Fantastic. Awesome. So with the corporations then, how did that game work and how did it link to the science game and the nation game and the rest of the things that were going on?
So part of the process of divorcing science from the nations was that the Watch the Skies science is a tech tree, and each of the scientists of the nations is kind of going up that tech tree, and we kind of realized we wanted to divide these. So the corps get the tech trees, and the corps sometimes can end up just being like sales bots who are just helping other players along. They're kind of Sherpas for the nations to reach the top of the mountains or whatever. So we fleshed out the corporation game. They have to get, like, it's a fairly sort of common trope, is they have, like, corporations in your game have to increase their share price and they're competing against each other. But they just now have loads and loads of different ways of boosting their share price. Like, nations can sell them mineral rights, and they can they can persuade them to give them, like, tax breaks. And there's loads of little points of kind of communication. Like, the scientists need them for some stuff, they need the scientists for some stuff, like
so their tech trees are blocked in certain areas and they can only actually access further up their tech trees with stuff from the science teams, so they have to go and work with the science teams, i.e. help give them funding because they've got lots of money, and then the science team can give them bits of breakthrough which will allow them to get to the next bit of advanced technology.
And so, yeah, the corps are still, like, a large part of the game is spitting out stuff that like techs that nations can use to basically kill each other. But we've tried quite hard to give them, civilian techs, like economic techs and so on, and other stuff that's useful. And we basically also devolved all of that output into action cards. So they have these tech trees. There were 8 tech trees in the first game. That may be reduced slightly. 8 tech trees and then some advanced tech trees. And these, you know, you research, you go up the tech tree, you research stuff, then you have a certain amount of manufacturing you can do each turn. That generates, you can use that to generate whichever cards you want, and then you go and sell those cards to people. And, you know, some of those cards in the first design were too powerful and some of them were not powerful enough, and we're, this evening before the podcast, actually, we were going through them and deciding which one should stay and which one should go.
Ah, of course, of course.
The other key bit difference probably with the corp is they don't actually use money to build stuff. They've got a preset amount of build points, which they can increase, which allows them to produce these cards. So there isn't this sort of infinite loop where they start getting so much money, they can build more stuff because they're pumping more of the money into their build and they can just buy more and more of these cards to sell. They're actually all sort of not limited, but they're all sort of kept on a sort of equalish output range. So no corporation is running away because it started making money early on.
That makes sense. That's definitely something I've seen in a lot of mega games, is the infinite money towards the end of the game, or the moment when you just end up producing so many resources that it starts to get out of control.
Yeah, so we've tried to cap that. It's
So one of the sort of design tropes we wanted to get away with is that because economies are so difficult to balance, and we definitely didn't balance it very well. This is mostly my fault for wanting to put more money in than the others did. Anyway, we didn't balance the economy very well, and that's everybody else's fault but me. But at the end, you end up with people like being encouraged to embezzle money from the game, and sometimes you get these like status items put in. And in some games, that's thematic. Games about like organized crime or whatever, I found buying like mansions in the country and so on to be quite thematic. But otherwise, it's just like a kind of very, to me, artificial cash sink. And we didn't want to be taking money. Money needs to be taken out of the game, obviously, but we didn't want money taken out of the game for things that people weren't getting anything for. So we changed the cash sink into this kind of share price scoring thing. And that kind of changes how people see money. We don't want people to end up with pockets full of money at the end of the game where they're like, ha ha ha, I stole money from the team because that seemed like funny. We want money to be always a valuable, always be valuable for the team, and not like to encourage people. Like, there's been so many games I've come out at the end where someone I trusted on my team was like, look, I've got pockets and pockets of money. I was like, I wanted to buy a gun, and you said money. And that's always upset me. So now I'm designing the tyrant of my own game.
You're the kid who was bullied, and now you're designing a world where they can't bully you.
When I design my own mega game, you'll all see.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody has to address me properly.
It's funny that there's that instinct, because in one of my games, I think we came the closest to ever seeing, you know, real player attrition. Animosity, I suppose, because of that, like, total betrayal and hoarding of resources and real sort of malicious intent in what was meant to be seemingly malicious. It was all pretty role-play what was meant to be a cooperative setting. But it seems to be an instinct. People just get into a game, they realize there's an economy, and they're like, well, I'm going to have to get all the things.
We deliberately designed away from that. So we spent a lot of time talking about, do you want any teams with like doppelgangers in, say, or like someone who's briefing to be a traitor?
Traitors.
Or like, are we giving players, are we even giving people individual briefings? And we rapidly moved away from that. The team briefing is something that everybody on a team gets. There's no one who's like got a secret special agenda or anything, and there's no one being briefed to double cross people. And we also got rid of player assassinations as well, which is, you know, I mean, that's not especially innovative from us, but some games allow it more than others, and we were like very, very clear that there's no player assassination. It's not fun. It generates a load of admin for the game, and all you really do is take them out for a bit and say, okay, you're back doing, you're the same guy in the same role, but you've been killed. And that doesn't, no one enjoys that.
Yeah.
And like, it's just the same with those double cross mechanics. Like, they're not enjoyable for everyone. A similar example, right? In a game like this, where people aren't sort of playing Rambo, they're just playing like Mr. Defense Minister or whatever. But sometimes you get like NGOs, or you get like terrorist organizations or something, where you are playing individuals, and that's kind of unfun, asymmetric play, we realized. Like, if somebody's job is to blow up infrastructure in a game where you're not targeting individuals, you're targeting armies, only one side of that equation is having fun. So we made a lot of decisions to take the personal out, and to make it really, really like high scope stuff.
Team focused.
Yeah, team focused, exactly. Where like you are playing the government of a country, not the guy who happens to be the Home Secretary of England. Britain, rather, not England, obviously.
That makes total sense. Awesome. And finally, I think we better move on to the war map. I'm very interested to see how this worked in the large-scale mega game. How many different kind of map sections did you have, and how did they work on the day?
I'm conscious I'm talking a lot. Zane, you can take this if you like, otherwise I'll just keep babbling.
So we had five maps, five regions, with about five teams around each one. A couple of the maps had six teams around them. That's essentially how it worked. And a fairly simple sort of just move your troops around a couple of spaces. Each kind of country had its own borders, and you could move one or two spaces each turn. That was the sort of really simplistic bit. And then it's a very simple, each unit has a strength, and the team with the highest strength is the winner. It was kind of, that's how simple we ended up being. There was a little bit of variable from a card draw that might give you a little bit of a plus, just to give you some variable. And then the action cards you could play that you'd bought from the corporations to help adjust that battle. So,
did you have any limit on the action cards, like how much you can play each time? Yeah,
so you could only play action cards equal to the number of units you had in the conflict.
So that makes sense.
You were limited by how many units you had, and your units as well were not, you couldn't buy it. It was kind of within the scale of the game, and quite common for sort of Watch the Skies as well, really, that the scale of the game means you can't buy new armies particularly or invent new ones. So every nation had a sort of a military budget, and the amount of military budget they put allowed them to deploy a certain preset amount of units. So if they dropped their budget, they had to bring people off the map. If they increased their budget, they could put more units on. And once units were dead, they were dead. That was it. But we also had a very similar interception sort of air combat, as in Watch the Skies. Aliens arrived as sort of radar tokens, so we used round poker chip ones, two-sided. So the alien ones had a radar blip on one side, and then the type of UFO it was on the other, and the interceptors had whether they were damaged or undamaged. And the aliens in the sort of end of the phase would come and put their radar blips down, and then at the beginning of the next turn, the humans could put their interceptors down, flip over, see what they'd actually managed to intercept, resolve combat through a simple card. So
nice.
Fairly similar to what Watch the Skies was, but it's a good mechanic. Sort of why change it? We did think about it, we looked at it, and it's a slightly different card draw, but it is essentially you draw a card and you see how much damage your unit inflicts on the other one and how much the other one managed to dodge.
The real difficulty, difficulty is the wrong word, but the challenge is getting feedback from the map, which is really only meant to be attended by like operational military commander players and the alien players whose job it is to go to the map as well. And the rest of the game, because we have like quite a lot of relatively complex simulation about all the different crises and stuff and how that's meant to feed back onto your like GDP and so on. And we really want the map to feel more than just like a kind of battlescape, especially as the game isn't really set up for people to be constantly going to war with each other. I mean, we'd like a little bit of that, but not too much of that. And so that's, again, where the kind of liaison control come in, and their job is to kind of inform people, oh, well, you know, there's a huge drought affecting the entire region, and there are refugees coming into your country, and so on and so forth. And like, we're looking at ways to boost how that went, because it kind of went fine, but it was kind of not evenly applied. But like, I really think there's a lot of potential in these games to make the map more of a focal point than just a place where fighting happens.
Right,
that makes sense. Awesome. And I wanted to get into these objectives and the goal cards that you guys devised. I heard you talk about them on the Mega Game Assembly podcast a bit, and it's actually something I've been looking at in my own designs. So I'd love to hear, what was the inspiration behind these and how did they work?
So the inspiration was the sort of fishing wars between the UK and France, which I don't know how aware you are over in Australia of the conflict between fishing rights between us and other nations, but
not at all.
there have been actual sort of fights and fishing boats have got in trouble and stuff like that. So it's quite a volatile.
Conservative MPs love to like make a big grandstand about how like the Johnny Foreigner is coming over and taking our territorial water.
Stealing our fish, yeah. What came to me was, wouldn't it be great if there was actually a card that said fishing rights and actually you were trying to get hold of that card? Because in my mind, as the French player, I'd be like, we need that card. We're briefed to have the fishing right card, because there's a difference between having a briefing that says you should have the fishing rights, that's fine, but actually having a physical object that you want in your possession changes it, I think, in a sort of, there's a psychological difference there, that if you know the other person has got the card you want, there's something you can do about it and try and get hold of it. Unfortunately, in the game, I don't think they cared about that particular card, but from that grew this sort of wonderful...
It was a real eureka moment for that, because we really, really like went to town on it, and there's objective cards of all sorts now, and some of them worked as intended and some of them didn't, and would sort of, I think that's as much like down to each individual, how each individual player has like responds to it on the day, but some of them worked an absolute treat. There were some where people were just fighting over stuff all day, and there was There's one actually, I don't want to talk about too many of these because it's spoilers, but there's one that's kind of relevant to you guys, because there are some, they're not even, Chris spent ages basically diligently looking at all of the different conflicts that might emerge between all of the countries in the game in the real world. And for Australia, he found some islands called the Ashmore and Cartier Islands, which are like, if you squint really hard, are somewhat disputed between Indonesia and Australia. And there's this tiny little territory on the map, which is these islands that's kind of some way between Australia and Indonesia on the map. And they're both briefed to want them. Australia starts in control of them and Indonesia has this briefing, we want them back. And the Indonesian team did nothing about it for turn after turn, nothing. And the Australians forgot that they even had it. Then in turn seven, while the rest of the world was going absolutely to shit, Indonesia invaded in force, conquered the islands, got their little GDP boost from it, and were like, the Australians were like, what is going on? And that was just a really brilliant moment for everyone. Like the Indonesians, who like might be considered one of the smaller economically nations, not population, but economically smaller nations in the world, like had a real moment from that. And like they'd put loads of planning in and all sorts. And it was just like, it's really satisfying when you discover that people have enjoyed themselves.
Talking of the Indonesians, just quickly, I think I walked past the Indonesian like foreign minister or something talking to a facilitator at one point, because this must have been prior to the invasion, which I didn't even know had happened until just then. But the facilitator was saying, oh, yes, you've got your people on the island now, but the Australians are offering them citizenship. What are you going to do? It's just, as I walked past this conversation was happening, it was brilliant, because it's like, yeah, well, how would you respond to that? You could offer them your own citizenship instead? Like, for money, not to take the citizenship? It's fantastic.
Love it.
We're just on the objective card 1 second. I think the point of them was it sort of didn't matter if people went with them or not. It's the fact that they're there to jump off and get involved with other countries. They were sort of there to say, look, you can go and talk to this country. If you don't really know what to do, you've got a brief that says go and get this thing or go and ask for this card. Yeah.
Because to take the fish example, sorry, Chris.
No,
if you brief England and France to fight over fish, but you don't give them anything for it, maybe one of them will say, I'm here for your fish, and then they'll laugh and nothing will happen. But largely it's something they can ignore. But if there's like a material object that they're told to get and there's a tiny little economic bonus or some other reward for it, people are much more likely to go for it. And and it's just like a lever to pull, an incentive and so on.
Yeah, the fishing card was inspired. I mean, Zane thought it up, but from that branched off all sorts of other objectives. Like we had various looted items, obviously from the 1800s, when the British and the French and the other colonial powers were running around stealing various countries' artifacts. Like we have a lot of those in the game. For the second run, we've now spun it out to the Olympics as well. So it really made it, because it's obviously, you have some smaller countries like Indonesia, say, for example, or some African countries. Like, what do you want them to do? Like, in the game, you can't, they're not huge military powers. They can't fly off to the moon because they don't have the technology necessarily. So what do you give them to do? And yeah, the fish card just kind of inspired all sorts of wacky ideas and things we could do, which was really, really good.
It sounds like it achieved exactly what you were after. And I feel like it's going to end up in mega game design vocab as the fish card.
I would love it to be the fish card. Yeah, totally. That's what we call it.
I'm just wary of time. I'm going to run through a quick little fast fire of questions just about how you run things on the day, because I'm keen to get to talking about what work you've done on the game since then, leading into May when you run this again. But just on running the actual day, we've talked a little bit about communication, the logistics, people not showing up. Broadly speaking, for each of the three of you, how was the experience of running it in comparison to what you thought? Like, did it meet your expectations? Did anything catch you sort of left field? Or did it kind of happen the way that you expected after playing in these things so many times?
Yeah, I was just going to jump in. I think, to be honest, it went incredibly smoothly. Like, I've run a few games before this one, and I was expecting it to be chaotic and difficult, and it ran disappointingly smooth. I felt that Chris and Tom needed to learn how difficult it could be, but no, it was logistically a real smooth sort of operation.
Yeah, it was so smooth that I became about, I don't know, a quarter way through the day, I became biscuit facilitator. So I would just want to walk around with cookies and biscuits and give them to the facilitators, because I really had nothing to do. I could be playing. That's how little I had to do.
Yeah.
But that was preceded by quite an intense period of prep and boxing up.
Before the game, like, oh my God.
How long was it that you were working on the game before it launched?
A long time. So we had decided to go ahead with talking to Jim about it in the last game we had before lockdown, which was, I think, the month before lockdown, maybe a month and a half before lockdown. Yeah. And then lockdown very fortuitously happened. Great time. We all loved it. And I describe this to people who aren't in the Mega Games orbit as like a lockdown project that got way out of hand. And that's basically like, if we hadn't had all this dead time, and I was in a job where I did not have very much work to do if you really got down to it. So I had like loads of dead time just to write and rewrite rule books. So that's the only reason we could do it, because we spent thousands of man hours on it. We spent way more time than usually gets spent on these mega games just by the physical constraints of like relativity.
Yep.
And because there were four of us and because no one had anything else to do, we wouldn't be able to pull a ground up design like this again off, I don't think. It's too much work.
Never say never. But
maybe that's unfair. I think it would have less work put into it just by dint of the fact that I'd like to leave the house now.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Circumstances. So then running the game. Well, I mean, I think everyone on this in this conversation have had that moment where you have the game well packed and designed, where you kind of get a bit shocked about why everything's going well and to plan. I remember, Jack, I think you were talking, and maybe on your Mega Game Assembly interview, about God Emperor, where you were kind of almost wanting to be needed, but
in that game I was overall game control. I was just there to put out fires, and there weren't any fires, so I kind of just floated around. It was a bit like, what's happening?
So I guess I was going to ask, like, you know, in the grand scheme, what happened, like, it being such a huge, very big, large game, or however it is called, you guys have labeled it a very large, huge game. What went wrong, or what was the worst thing about the day? But it kind of sounds like you might not have one.
I mean, we mentioned Slido and the technology.
Technology was terrible. But that was truly awful. But I don't think. I'm trying to rack my brains here. I don't think. I mean, I really did just have biscuits.
It was a very hot day.
It was so hot.
UK, not for you guys. It was really hot.
Yeah, it was one of our hottest days ever, I think.
A lot of people weren't that.
Sorry, I was going to say, and the lunch.
The lunch queue. There was
a cafe in the venue, and the sort of game sort of accidentally were sort of ground to a halt for a bit longer than we wanted because everyone was trying to queue up to get lunch.
That was actually my fault, because I was talking to the venue like a few months before, and the guy was like, oh, well, I can give out menus and people can pre-book food. I'm like, no, they won't do that. Don't worry about that. It's fine. Just ignore that. We're not going to give them any options.
Yeah.
And that came back to bite me on the arse. Absolutely. Okay. So, yes, next time around, we're definitely going to offer people an option just to pick up food. Make it as easy as possible.
And do you know, just lastly, ballpark, do you know how many people who came to this as their first mega game?
Right.
We've somehow, through reorganizing our Google Drive, we've lost the form, but I think we had about 140 people respond to our casting questionnaire, and in that we had, is this your first game, or have you played before? And I'm pretty sure about half of them at that point had never played before. So Tom, you'd arranged to send an email out to London on Board, which is like a big board gaming group here in the UK. I think was it 10,000 people on the list, something like that.
I mean, I don't think it's 10,000 active accounts, but
it's a huge, like, for us it's huge, and we got a lot of people from that mail, I believe, because certainly our ticket sales shot up after that, and a lot of them obviously had never played or heard of a Meg game before, so I think that probably drove a lot of new people.
Right.
I remember you saying 60% at one point, Chris. Remember?
Yeah, it was honestly very high. I must have deleted the forms. I can't find the data anymore, but it was very high. It was 50 to 60% of new players, definitely. And even just wandering around the room and looking at photos afterwards, I don't recognise a lot of people. Like, the people I recognise are generally the ones that are helping us, because we corralled them to do so.
we found the UK mega game community is only a few hundred people, really. Like, I mean, there's obviously like some who come to like one game a year, and there's like the regulars, but it's not a gigantic pool of people by any means. And I think we discovered that quite a lot of people had wandered away in the kind of few years where we weren't allowed outside. Plus, also, I think there'd been some change, because it's basically organized via Facebook, and a lot of people have left Facebook, and Facebook has also changed its algorithm. And it shows people posts in, so the main nexus is Mega Game Makers. I almost never see posts in Mega Game Makers now, and I always used to. I think promoting mega games has become harder. It's just difficult to reach people now.
It sounds like it was a huge success, but you're running it again soon. And you mentioned you've shortened the rule books a lot. How did you achieve, like, which bits did you really want to cut out? And is there any, like, golden rules that you learned about rule book design or anything like that?
We were talking about this before the recording a bit, so apologies if I repeat myself. But basically, most of our rule books, most of the 17 rule book, is it 17 at the moment, or are there more?
17, I think.
So most of the 17 rule books we have are 10 pages or under. And so if you're the leader of a country or an interior minister, you'll have a role rule book that's 8 pages or less. And then you'll have like the human rule book that everybody gets, and you'll have, which was a lot longer as it's been divided into two, and you'll have the nation's rule book. And that's not a lot to read. It was a lot to read when the human rule book was like 25 pages long and repeated itself loads. But the real danger was the military commander handbook, which was getting on for 40 pages, and they also had to read the long-ass human rulebook. And we realized we were just haven't taken a load of rules out. We were just repeating ourselves over and over again, and we've just looked at it, gone back at it, and with fresh eyes after not looking at it and obsessing over it for 6 months, and just cut out all the stuff that is saying the same thing. And that's how to write a short rule book is edit yourself properly.
Mm-hmm. I'd say, because I mean, a lot of this challenge sort of came from myself. I'm very dyslexic, so any rule book that's kind of over 10 pages, I start to struggle to properly comprehend. So it was a kind of like, can we really cut this down? Because other people like myself are going to find it hard to actually comprehend. And yeah, it's all the stuff was useful in there, but in that challenge made us really be quite ruthless in cutting stuff out, and probably more ruthless than we would have been without that challenge. I think it was a fine rule book, but it's nice to cut it down and sort of try and keep things. The other one is trying to use a lot of more sort of visuals. We had a bit more time. Other Tom, who's our graphics guy, hopefully has got some time now to look at doing sort of examples with pictures and graphics. So I think that cuts out a lot.
Mm. Yeah. One of the things that Zane hit on way too late to really make a difference, not make a difference. Sorry, that sounds ruder than I meant to. One of the things Zane hit on too late that was really good were these cheat sheets that he did, where basically he boiled down all of the complex combat rules into graphical illustrations and had them on single A5 pages. And that cut through pages and pages and pages of difficult text, because the combat is not complex, but it has, even with that, it has 10 steps if you write it out like very exactly. And that is much better information, much better delivered with images and examples. And we've now incorporated those into the rule books, which is partly why the Military Commander rule book is about 40% smaller, is because all the waffle, all the kind of hard to explain in words and long paragraphs are gone.
Yeah, right.
It's just much better. So the big learning actually really is don't give your rule books to a writer, give them to a guy who hates words.
That's a good lesson.
You know, I sound like I'm being glib, but actually, in all seriousness, it's so much clearer with the visual information what is going on with combat, and like it's a sort of Gordian knot type situation for me.
Yep. No, it's something I'm actually going through right now as we record. I'm preparing to run God Emperor in May, and those rules don't need any sort of attention. They've been run many times. It's Jack's great design, but
thanks, man.
I'm looking at how to prep players for it, and I'm actually looking at visualizing and making some mini videos and that kind of thing for how to explain them. And once you start visualizing some of the operational rules, they're so simple. Whereas I used to think, oh, this is a bit complex. There's a lot of steps. Mm. So yeah, it's 100%. It's a key to rules design.
One thing I'd like to drop in actually right now in position is our rule books on the first run were laid out very kindly by Nelly from Melbourne Mega Games, who was very, very sweet about us increasingly frantically saying, can you switch this page around? Can you move this rule around? And so on and so forth, because she was doing it out of the goodness of her heart. I mean, we're giving her a copy of the game, which actually, Nelly, we need to do that if you're listening. but you can either have the first edition or the suit. You can have both if you like. It doesn't matter. Anyway, she was very gracious about basically doing an unpaid job for a bunch of people right the other side of the world who she'd never met before. And it was very cool. And they looked amazing, like the whole layout. We got loads of, even though the rule books were too long and a bit complicated, we got loads of compliments on how good they looked, and we wouldn't have been able to lay them out like that. So I just wanted to name check that.
Yeah, no, that's great. And something I didn't know until I was chatting to you just the other day, and great quality as well. Like, I've seen Nelly's work and it's really there's a trick to how to lay out these books and make sure that people can digest them well. So we'll put Nelly's personal contact details in the show notes. So anyone who wants some free work on the real book, can reach out.
Nelly.
Only say thank you for that, I am sure.
Thank you, Nelly. I guess with the reworks, we're going to sort of delve into nitty gritty of a few things, but really what I was really keen to hear about was, if you could talk about it, was leading up to May. It sounds like you've had this amazing first run. You've revised a couple of things. You've cut out decreased the size of the books to make them a bit clearer. But are there any major overhauls that you're changing ahead of the second run? Things that you've entirely changed or new things you've added?
I think the biggest thing we've cut out is probably most of my Crisis game.
Okay.
Under my instruction, so isn't someone going, get rid of your bit of the game, Zane. It was just a little bit complex, and I have a little liking of a bit of crunch, but it was a bit too much. Every crisis sort of generated sort of refugees and pollution and things like this, and in my mind, people would be dealing with it in different ways, but the game was too big to deal with that level of detail, so we've cut all of that flavour out, and it just has a single Terror type token instead. Yeah. We still have the crisis cards. There's still a card which sits standing on the map that says earthquake, but it just creates havoc or terror or whatever, rather than refugees and hurt people and disease or whatever it happens to be. So it's just taking that out. So players still have to deal with crisis, but they don't have to really care or remember whether it's refugees or whatever.
I might have PTSD about this because in a couple of weeks before the game, and there's a few things to do still, and one of them was to cut out these meter square boards of centimeter size tokens that late Zane just alluded to. So I'm not bitter. No, not at all. It's fine.
We'll use them in another game. Don't worry.
Yeah,
I promise we'll use those tokens. Mm. Otherwise, you'll make me eat them.
You spent literal days with a guillotine separating.
It was a Stanley knife. It was a guillotine. Crikey, it was a Stanley knife. Yeah, it was a week, I think, a week and a half, something like that. But I'm not bitter, though. It's fine. What are you mentioning it for?
The trouble is, no one really understood what they were doing because the rule book was so long that this kind of small mention of how there were like 9 different impact tokens from crises and you had to work out how to sort them out just fell on deaf ears. So there'd be these crises on the map and there'd just be more and more refugees pouring out. People were like, is that what? Never mind. And would just ignore them. So this is a very good example of why less can be more.
Yes.
We've made the turns a little bit longer. We've added some time for people to get round the venue in between phases, especially because we had a lot, because the venue's lovely, but it's not one big room. It's several medium-sized rooms on different floors. And sometimes people coming from the far-flung floors were missing half the press broadcast, so we've added like 2 minutes travel time, and we've put team time at the start of the game, the turn, and so on. And we've just kind of made lots of like quality of life things as well, just to stop people having to kind of dash around a hall and shoulder people out of the way to listen to a guy on stage.
Awesome. So with all these changes, what are you most looking forward to about the next run in May?
Playing it. I'm abandoning the guys and I'm going to play it.
Good.
That's my long dream of doing what I wanted to play. I wanted to play this game. That's why it's got involved.
Has been achieved, which is like, even when we were talking about it, it was like, I want to do this, but only so I can play in it.
Yeah. I want to give up biscuits and play.
we're letting him off, and he's going to solemnly pretend he doesn't know any of the plot hooks.
Honestly, probably don't. we've written so much, I don't know what anybody's doing anymore.
You're just going to hear him in the background somewhere mid-game like, Indonesia, what?
Why are you doing that? Why do you want the Ashmore Cartier Islands? It's ours.
Well, that'll be good. And Tom, Zane, you're going to be still facilitating?
I'm way too much of a slap for attention, as you can tell, so I will be on stage comparing it still.
Yeah.
And I'll be handing out biscuits somewhere or just in a corner having a chat with players.
And saying it'll be consoling me because I've lost the Ashmore and Cartier Islands.
Telling him there's nothing I can do about it. Yeah. I think what I'm probably most looking forward to it is probably the day after. It's usually the best day.
That's always that's true. The easy. No matter how the game goes, that's always this blissful day of completion.
It's done, it's over. Or the moment after that it's finished. There's something, that moment is a designer and someone putting on games.
I feel like I've said once before in this one of these conversations that I always strive to have had run a mega game, and that's always the end goal, rather than I'm keen to design it, I'm keen to be there on the day and do it. I just want to be one step past it. Just before we wrap up,
the other thing I'm looking forward to is running the next thing, but that's probably my. I'm always thinking about the next game or five or six other games in my head.
Well, so. Of course, that's segues to my next question. But I have to say that's why I love that period just after the game, because that's when I get all my most productive design, work done. When you're fresh out of a mega game stew, but. What's the future look like? So for you individually, the three of you, but also for very large, huge games, you kind of implied earlier, Tom, that the amount of effort simply needed for this game won't happen again just because of circumstance and people are sort of not locked in their homes. But
that's speaking for myself there. Actually, Zane, you talk about what's going on.
What's going on, Zane?
Okay. What is going on? Good question. We have got game planned for after the summer. So we are going to scale up a game I ran quite a few years ago. And I think the first time I met you, Chris, wasn't it? I ran a game called Aftermath, which was a near extinction event has hit the world. And people in Britain are recovering, and it's the sort of juxtaposition between these little groups that have survived and what's left of government organizations and the police trying to rebuild. So they're sort of desperately trying to cling on and rebuild, but actually society's fallen apart, and lots of little groups that have are trying to make the world in their new vision. And it's a sort of classic post-apocalyptic-y kind of thing, but without zombies, without nuclear stuff, just sort of people.
Think Mad Max with tea and biscuits.
Yes.
Yeah, Mad Max with tea and biscuits, yeah.
And we'll throw a link in the podcast notes as well to the conversation you had with Harrison on the Mega Game Assembly recently about that, because I'd listened to it just the other day and you went into a lot of detail about that game. So that's on the horizon?
Yeah, we're planning with... doing a rewrite, and we're running it at UK Games Expo with the sort of the rewrite. But it's a game that has run a couple of times, so we know it's there. It's just scaling it up, which is exciting. And then I think me and Chris have got thoughts about large games.
I just batter Zane all the time. Like, we should run this one, Zane. We should do. And Zane just placates me, goes, yes, all right, shut up. And eventually I get in the way.
To be clear, I do want to part. I'm not saying I'm one and done and retiring. I just
you're out, Tom. You're out.
It'd be more of a collaborative.
No, I understand. So I guess that was the one thing that I really wanted to know. Very large, huge games. Will you continue? Is your goal to run these things that are beyond the usual 40 people in a hall, but keep them at this huge scale?
Yeah. I think I can speak for all of us and say, because part of that objective is bringing people to the hobby. And the best way to do that is have big enough games that draw enough people in of a high enough quality. That's a kind of bit I think we forgot at the beginning, that part of our remit is to put them at a premium quality. So components, design, everything feels really nice. So first time players feel like they're getting something quality.
Mm. Awesome.
Great. Yeah, like a blockbuster experience, definitely.
Awesome. I think that brings us to a close. Where can people go if they want to find out more about Very Large, Huge Games or First Contact?
I'll give you Chris's address and they can just pop around. Yes.
Please no.
You'll find him in his living room cutting up large squares.
Yeah, exactly. Tiny little squares from massive boards. If people head to verylargehugegames.com, we've got information about First Contact, and in the near future we'll have information about Aftermath as well, plus anything else we're going to be doing in the future.
Tickets are on sale now.
They yes. are, yeah. That's a good point, actually. They are on sale now. If you're listening to this and you're in the UK and it's before May 2023, then head to verylargehugegames.com.
You don't have to be in the UK.
Anywhere. If you're in Australia and want to come over, we would love to see you. You can play Australia with me as Ashmore and Cartier Islands. We'll take it. It's fine.
Awesome. Well, thank you all. Appreciate the time and putting up with our back and forth trying to find a good slot for our time zones.
No, thank you.
Good luck in May. Maybe we'll have a chat afterwards and see how things go the second time. Maybe you'll get that chaotic game that you wanted.
To be clear, the game was extremely chaotic.
Oh, yeah.
And it did end in nuclear conflagration.
Well.
Maybe we'll get a game where everybody just gets along.
Well, if Chris is playing this time, maybe that'll all happen a couple of turns earlier.
No, I'm a reformed character now. I don't believe in nuclear war anymore. No, I think it's off the cards.
Its reputation. Is it a global reputation that Chris is
going to? No, I'm completely a reformed character. Don't like it anymore. No, nuclear fire's bad. You guys.
On that note, thank you all, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.